and WBZH 910 AM, W245CT Hayward. Always streaming on
ABC
the Civic
News.
Media
I'm
app.
Chuck Sievertson. A strike that could affect the U.S. economy is possibly next Thursday. Members of the United Auto Workers Union rejected GM and Stellantis' latest proposal. That means more negotiations. UAW President Sean Fain.
A 14.5% increase over 4 years is deeply inadequate.
The Auto Workers Union demands a 40% increase in pay, the same as company presidents, a 32-hour work week, and the return of traditional pensions. It's a month since the deadly Maui wildfires. Marking progress since then, Hawaii Governor Josh Green.
We've received assurances of continued federal support and investment to help West Maui recover and rebuild. And we will support and care for the survivors of this disaster for as long as it takes.
Hurricane Lee's rip currents and big waves on the East Coast are possible later next week, say the forecasters. The new flu vaccine that's been used in South America was effective over half the time against strains there that are expected here, say CDC officials. This is ABC News. Democracy, artificial intelligence, and partnerships in technology and space being talked about by President Biden and Indian Prime Minister Modi shortly after the U.S. chief arrived in New Delhi ahead of the G20 summit. White House National Security Council's Kurt Campbell.
I think you'll see that there will be many more initiatives that come out of this visit.
And what you might take for granted, people in a small Alaskan village are now just getting indoor plumbing. For years, they collected river water or rainwater in buckets and disposed of waste at collection points. But now local officials are connecting people up. Baron Sample, principal at the local school.
Connecting the remaining of the village, again, helps reduce some of that hazardous products, and also just gives everyone else the access to clean and wash and take care of things. So.
More than 2 million Americans still have no indoor plumbing, says the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Those with generally have fewer illnesses. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. The Wisconsin Elections Commission has approved a new emergency rule to create a formal policy for ballot challenges for candidates. Republican Commissioner Bob Spindle urged the commission to kill the plan, stating the rule opens the door to use the 14th Amendment to keep former President Donald Trump off the ballot and predicts a flood of lawsuits over the rule change. The rule change was approved by a 5-1 vote, with Spindle as the only outlier. Wisconsin Democratic lawmakers are pushing a 10-bill package to make it easier for Wisconsin workers to form a union. The 10-bill package would ease requirements to qualify for union ratification and would require companies to recognize unions. It is not expected that the bills will advance to Governor Tony Evers' desk, however, as the legislature is controlled by a near-Republican supermajority. Democratic Representative Katrina Shanklin says union action has led to major wins for workers in Wisconsin. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Wisconsin traditions have been built for years around the Badgers, game day, and the mascot. But lead miners are the original Badgers in the state, not the animal or the mascot. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like Badgers by digging tunnels into the hillsides to stay warm and sleep where they worked. It led to the reason why today you really can't think of Wisconsin without thinking Badgers. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
That must be kept at extremely low temperatures when shipped.
That is good news.
And finally, the Biden administration this week moved to impose a permanent ban on oil drilling across millions of acres of pristine Alaskan wilderness. The conservation action does not affect the controversial Willow Project due to a court judgment. In a separate announcement, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland moved to cancel all Trump-era drilling leases that had been permitted in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and restored the refuge's decades-long drilling ban.
Protections to be restored to ANWR.
Yep.
Excellent news. We'll take it. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to be doing a best of today. Something bizarre, something weird, something breaking happened in the Smith household today. My teenage daughter asked me if I would come to her high school football game to see her march in the marching band, her very first performance in the marching band, and she's been working so hard. So the fact that she asked, anyone who's had teenagers knows that when there's an ask, yeah, you have to go above and beyond to fulfill. And look, I want to be there. I want to see her first performance. I want to see what she's been working hard at and what she's proud of. And so today we're on the program, going to spend a little time looking back at some of my favorite interviews. So we're going to go a politician. We're going to go Senator Day. Senator Markey from Massachusetts, Senator Doug Jones former Senator Doug Jones from Alabama, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood going to be here. Going to share some thoughts. These are interviews we've done over the past several months. Some topical stuff, even this moment. The Supreme Court, big front and center, increasing the minimum wage, fighting for democracy. So today, I thought it'd be a good idea just to take a breath, look back, and go, hey, these are some really good interviews and some really good information, and I hope folks will enjoy them. I feel every time we take a day off, I feel bad. It's one of those things where, you know, fighting for democracy and fighting for better humanity. You can't take a day off. You can't take a day off from the fight for a better tomorrow. But like I said, you know, when the teenage daughter asks,
you jump through. You figure it out. But, you know, this is one of those weird moments where, you know, I'm a big believer in fighting the good fight. And what's frustrating to me, and I had this weird moment recently where one of the left, one of the liberal kind of think tank groups basically told me that they're never coming on the program because of the time. And I'm going, really? You know, the right, they don't know what time it is. They are willing to go everywhere. And this is where the left, I think, got a little lazy. And it triggered a memory of a former labor leader that I used to be friendly with who told me, well, you know, we need to be more mission oriented. Now, his view was, this is why we need to break labor laws and not really adhere to, you know, those things that we advocate and we fight for. But, you know, mission driven. And I agree with mission driven 100%. But I think you can do that in a way that still respects workers' rights and still plays within the bounds. Rearranging things. Flexibility, that's there. But it's weird to me because my liberal groups, you know, they got bankers' hours, most of them. And it's one of those things where you go, you wonder why we lose most of the messaging arguments. Because our messengers, well, they got weekends off. They got bankers' hours. It's a little angering and a little frustrating. But that's just my thought. But today, as I said, taking the day to go. Right now, I am watching my daughter march in the band. And I got to tell you, I'm looking forward to it. So we're going to take a quick break. Right back with the good senator. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1941. The ravages of World War II had swept across Europe. German troops had invaded Norway in April of 1940. The conditions of the Nazi occupation grew increasingly harsher. The Nazis began rationing milk, an important part of the diet of Norwegian children and workers. The rationing, however, did not apply to the German occupiers. Angered shipyard workers in Oslo walked off the job in protest. Workers from other industries joined them. 20,000 workers from 50 factories and work sites participated in the strike. The Nazi response to the uprising was predictably swift and brutal. 200 labor leaders were arrested and new Nazi chosen leaders put in their places. 27 of the arrested labor leaders and strikers were brought before a court-martial trial. Rolf Wickstrom, a welder and union steward, and Harold Viggo Hansteen, a labor lawyer, were sentenced to death for their involvement in the strike and executed. The remaining 25 strikers were convicted and sentenced to long prison sentences. Ludwig Bulin, a union railway worker, died while serving his prison sentence. So did Harry Vesely, a factory worker. Journalists were fired or arrested. Even groups like the Boy Scouts were banned. Listening to foreign broadcasts on the radio were expressly forbidden. Then radios were confiscated. In Sweden, trade unionists issued this statement in support of their fellow Scandinavian workers. They wrote, quote, "Norwegian trade unionists have fallen in the battle for Norway's freedoms and for the right of the Norwegian working class to decide for itself its own actions with the limits of Norwegian law. We honor their memory." In 1948, a memorial was placed to honor the deaths of Wickstrom and Hansteen and the workers who stood up for their country. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Mitch McConnell has come out and said that there's no secret plan in the Senate to bail out the White House. No, he said that the White House and the Speaker's teams need to sit down and settle it. He's not going to help on the debt ceiling, not even a little bit. And my first thought is, you know, I don't know, if you're a U.S. senator, I mean, do you not want the country to do well? Isn't this one of those moments where you're kind of pushing both sides a little bit more than just saying, I'm doing nothing? or is this doing something? And here to answer that question, I've asked former U.S. Senator from Alabama, Doug Jones, to come share his thoughts on the whole debt ceiling debacle. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's always great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So am I too hard on Mitch McConnell? This my view is he's just making it worse. Or is this how McConnell motivates?
Well, I don't know if it's how he motivates. I mean, I've yet to figure that out with Senator Mitch. But I will say it is a complete abdication of his constitutional duties. The president of the United States, at least unless there is some constitutional challenge, which may be in the works if they don't get something out, the president can't raise the debt ceiling. Only the Congress of the United States can do that. So everybody, you know, McCarthy and McConnell are putting this all on the president. But the fact of the matter is, it's their duty to get this done and get it done in a way that the president will sign it. And so I really think that Mitch is just, you know, I don't know why he feels like he can just sideline the entire Senate. That's not the way the Congress is supposed to operate. And they need to be in the middle of this. They can be very practical if they want to. But you are right about this, Rick. And that is that for anyone to basically say, I'm not going to get engaged in something that could have catastrophic consequences for the economy of the United States, catastrophic consequences for the global economy, much less the absolute full faith and credit of the United States of America, I think is shameful. I really think statements like that are shameful.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, here's the thing, and I see us in this moment, and maybe you'll agree or disagree because I really want your thoughts on this. I look at the Freedom Caucus and many in the House, the House Republicans, as looking at this hostage situation as truly wanting to shoot the hostage. I believe there are people in the House that want to default, that want to touch the button, that want to blow this up and cause the chaos so they can blame Biden for it and a whole bunch of other ideological things. But then I see on the side of on Biden's side where you go, you got to be the adult in the room and say, look, I'm not going to deal with children who are willing to destroy the country. At some point, we've got to end this. And there's talk around the 14th Amendment and him being able to do something there. There's part of me that goes, you know, he just does that. So I want to get your thought. Is there a viable path to using the 14th Amendment to get rid of this or to set it aside to avoid this crisis? I'm curious.
Well, first of all, Rick, let me say I agree with you that there are those in the House and probably some in the Senate and Republicans across the country that would like to see this blow up. They want to see the economy tank. And that's a horrible thing to say. But I go back to 2020 and I remember specifically reading. And if you go back to the fall, spring and summer of 2020, what you saw was the beginning of inflation, the higher gas prices, and Republicans were gleeful. They were literally gleeful because you saw the president's numbers going down. You saw Democrats' chances in the midterms going down. And I remember specifically reading an article with a former member of Congress. He phrased it this way because then you had the war in Ukraine started, and all of a sudden things started turning around. People started looking at democracy more than they did inflation, and Democrats' fortunes started to turn around. And this former Republican congressman said, you know what, with inflation and higher gas prices, we had everything going for us. And then the war started. Well, everything going for us, my God, this was hurting American families. It was hurting the working men and women in this country and the children that they're trying to raise. But he was more concerned and gleeful with the prospect that the economy tanking was helping them in the midterm. That I think is there. The 14th, and so I completely agree with you on that. Look into 2024. On the 14th Amendment, I think that that's a really interesting legal concept, a legal theory that has not been tested yet. We haven't had to test it, Rick. The debt ceiling is routinely raised. I did it two or three times when I was in the Senate. when Donald Trump was president and the Republicans controlled the Senate, you didn't hear Mitch McConnell then abdicating his responsibilities. It's been fairly routine with some bumps in the road. But the way the Constitution reads, there may be the authority of the president to simply say to the Treasury, borrow more money and pay the debts and pay our bills and let somebody challenge that. I think it's really interesting. I would not like to see that happen. What you really want to see is the Congress of the United States stepping up to do their dang job.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. I think the Republicans are so dug in, and I think McCarthy has sold his soul to be Speaker to the point to where they're going to push this as far as they have to, and to keep him in the speakership, and that being self-serving. The country, you know, be damned. Our economy be damned. Our role in the world be damned. I mean, I hear a lot of Republicans complaining about, you know, Russia and China and India and Brazil. They're going to have their own currency and they're going to be the reserve currency. Well, how about we not screw that up and give them a reason to do that?
Right. No, you're absolutely right in that. And what I'm hoping is, one, I'm hoping that they can cut some kind of deal. I'm hoping that they would do. When I say cut some kind of deal, I still think the president is right to hold out for a clean debt ceiling increase and a debt ceiling bill and say, and tell the other side, tell the Republicans that, look, if everything you want to talk about, we will talk about that in good faith during the appropriations process because that's where it is supposed to be.
Yep.
And the president should talk to folks about that. Democrats in Congress should talk to folks about that. That's the way legislation is done, not with a gun to your head. So that's number one. The second thing that I think I'm hoping that they might do if they can't cut some kind of deal right now is simply to do a CR, a continuing resolution. I don't like kicking the can down the road, but in this case, it might help to kick the can down the road so that discussions in the appropriations process can be going on simultaneously with the debt ceiling discussions. They wouldn't be separate, but they would at least be going on in the same time frame and try to get it done all at once, something like that to see. Yeah. But you know, what I go back to, Rick, is this. So many of the same Republicans voted for the very debt that they say now that they don't want to pay. They voted for it. They caused a lot of it by passing the 2017 tax bill. And, you know, it's really, I just can't understand any member of Congress totally abdicating their responsibilities.
Yeah, but I get your idea of passing a continuing resolution. My problem with that is we're still using the debt ceiling as a hostage tool. We're still using that. And I don't think that's what it should be. In every American household across this country, when the credit card bill comes due, you pay it. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. When your bills come due, you got to pay your bills, or your credit rating takes a dump and you have all of the negative consequences that come with that. I don't understand why Congress can't behave in the same fashion that they talk about every working class family in America having to deal with.
No, I agree. I totally agree with that, Rick. The only thing I'm saying is this. People are dug in, and we're living in a different world now than we've ever done. Had in terms of the polarization and the digging in and people really just going to war over things that they shouldn't be going to war over. And I'd rather see a CR like that where they can talk on similar tracks at the same time during the appropriations process and hopefully the economy not get destroyed.
Right.
The alternative is for there not to be a debt ceiling raise, the economy go to hell in a handbag with apologies to your wife. And that's going to be a real problem. That's going to be a major problem. And we don't want to see that happen. We've got to figure out a way to prevent that. And that doesn't mean giving in. But you've got to make sure that if there is any way possible to avoid that kind of economic collapse. We really need to do it, because in the end, it really won't matter who caused it, because people are going to be angry at everybody.
Yeah, no, and look, and the people at the bottom are going to be the ones who suffer the most. I understand that, and I get that. But, you know, there's a point at which you got to go, an adult has to step up and say, this kind of ticking bomb has to stop. It's not good for our position around the world. It's not good for our economy. It's not good for working people. It's just, it's something that should be abolished. Is there a way to get rid of this? Because, you know, again, I go back to, and this is the last place I want to finish on this, because there's part of me that goes, maybe if you do take this into the Supreme Court, which has been a very corporate court, you know, their decisions have come down on the side of the Chamber of Commerce much right. more often than not, that this would be a corporate decision to not hold the economy hostage, not screw over corporate America or working people. This could be a, and I hate using the win-win frame, but it could be one of those things where the sane people go, no, this is just bad. We should stop this.
No, I think it's a legitimate legal issue about the 14th Amendment and whether or not we can default when we've got the ability to go forward one way or another without legislation. I think that's a legitimate issue. I can't predict what the Supreme Court would do because, yes, it's been a very business-friendly court. At the same time, it has now become a very, very political court. And so if they, like I'm afraid that they have done in several cases in the last couple of years, decided it on politics rather than on the Constitution, then we could be in trouble.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. I'm hoping Biden does what I want him to do and say, no, we're not giving in. We're not caving. We're going to pay our bills like adults. You children sit down. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. I want to get your thoughts on this. I saw over the weekend the story coming out of New Hampshire. New Hampshire has become evidently the first state in the country to protect interracial marriage. Didn't think we had to do that. And now I see your state of Alabama, the Democrats in that state are abolishing the mandated LGBTQ caucus, the youth caucus, I guess the Hispanic caucus. What's going on? I mean, I thought this stuff was decided.
It should have been, Rick, and it is really demoralizing for Democrats in Alabama to see what the party leadership is doing. And that's what I'm saying. This is not the Democratic Party per se. This is party leadership who is just continuing to try to keep control. They are angry because we made the party more inclusive back about 4 years ago. And they didn't like it. They felt like it took away their control and their power. And it's a small group. This is not a major group, but they have influence with others. And it's really too bad. I mean, the Democratic Party in Alabama is just like it is around the country. We are should be a party with a big tent, that we're inclusive, that we celebrate the diversity. We celebrate the voices. We give opportunities for all people to participate. And what's happened in the Democratic Party of Alabama with this small group of the leadership is they've just done away with that. We spent a lot of time trying to get these caucuses into our bylaws so that we could bring in youth. I mean, Rick, but prior to 2019, when we really went to bat for the youth especially, out of the over 200 members of the State Democratic Executive Committee, there was only about 19 or 20 that were under the age of 35. Look what's happening around the country. Look what happened in Wisconsin. Look where things are headed. It is the youth of this country that are bringing the Democratic Party back. And for some reason, the Alabama Democratic Party leadership decides, they just don't know enough. We just don't care. We don't want to include, we want to be able to control them and not give them a voice. Same with the LGBTQ community, Hispanic, Asian Americans. It's really sad. A lot of people are angry about this. And so I'm hoping it will not stand.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I don't agree with on the extremes, but everyone should have a voice. And the Democratic Party is supposed to be that big tent. So this seems to go against that ethos of, you know, the part of the big tent party. So I thought it was interesting coming out of your state.
Well, the irony is we Democrats have been complaining consistently over the last couple of years about efforts from the Republican Party to suppress dissenters, to cancel people like Tinkerbell when they speak out against you. We have been speaking out against Republican efforts to suppress voters, making it harder to vote, not giving people the voice. And now in Alabama, this leadership of the party has done the exact same thing with the very constituencies that are helpful to the Democratic base and helpful to the party. It is beyond it is beyond something that people can understand. It's just beyond words as to why they're doing this. And it is just an old guard wanting to hang on to control and not releasing it. We see it, you know, Rick, we see this in institutions across the country. We see it in law firms and accounting firms and medical practices. When the founders of the firm and that really built the firm decide that they just don't want the younger generation coming in and telling them what to say. They would rather burn the house down. And that's what's happening in Alabama. They have decided that they are likely to burn the house down before they would relinquish control. We'll see what happens.
We'll see. Doug, I appreciate the time. Keep up the good work. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
All right, Rick. Great to be with you as always, buddy.
Thanks so much. Our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Let's talk. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
We human beings sometimes do some terrible things in pursuit of the almighty dollar. But to our credit, one moral line we humans don't cross is to profiteer by gouging sick people on the price of medicines their lives depend on. Unless, of course, you count executives of giant pharmaceutical corporations as human beings. Gouging patients is their preferred business model. It's a scream, then, to watch Big Pharma fall into a sky-is-falling fit over our government's long-overdue move to give us patients some bargaining power over this monopolistic industry. Under President Joe Biden's anti-inflation policy passed earlier this year, our Medicare program can now negotiate drug prices on our behalf. This will drastically lower what you and I are now forced to pay to the profiteers. For decades, Congress has coddled the corporate gougers, who maintain by far the largest lobbying army in Washington, allowing them to manipulate the patent laws and rig the system. Thus, we Americans pay 2 to 3 times more than people in other countries for the exact same medicines. Oh, whale drug executives, bloated profits give us the incentive to keep developing innovative new cures. Hold it right there, Slick. Most basic drug development is done by tax-funded medical researchers, not brand-name market hucksters. Mega drug outfits like Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Bristol-Myers spend more on advertising, exorbitant executive salaries, lobbying, and big stockholder payouts than on research. Still, these same greed hounds are suing Biden, howling that making them negotiate is an unconstitutional taking of their income. But hello, these scoundrels have been taking our income, health, and lives for years. This is Jim Hightower saying, I'm with Biden on this. To stay informed and involved, connect with Public Citizen at citizen.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for years, we've been talking about, you know, just how biased our Supreme Court under the leadership of Chief Justice John Roberts has become. And look, because the vast majority of decisions we know go towards the corporate, toward the moneyed interest. And I've been saying, you know, just for a long time that workers, all they want is a fair shake. We want a fair shake from our high court, and we're not getting it. So the question is, you know, with all the recent disclosures around Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, and now you've got Chief Justice Roberts saying he's not going to come and testify in front of the Senate, you know, how can working people get a fair shake when our court appears to be bought and paid for by the very wealthy? And that's why I've asked Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse to come share some thoughts with us. Senator, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, this is where my mind starts. Let's start here, Senator. I mean, average everyday working people just want their court to be fair, want to get a fair shake in front of the court. How can we have a system where, you know, our justices are being wined and dined and vacationed and flown around by the very wealthy and powerful when working people don't have that kind of access?
Well, the problem is that billionaires do have that kind of access, and they have been working it. Highly motivated billionaires, I should add, have been working it to exert control over the court in a whole variety of ways, from being in the background as that Federalist Society list was put together, to advising Trump on which judges he should pick off the list, to funding the ads for the nominees who were chosen, to sending flotillas of front groups into the court as what they call amici curiae, friends of the court, to write briefs telling the court what they want them to do. So the pattern of all of this overlays in a very unpleasant way with the pattern of billionaire influence and generosity and secrecy around the Thomas gifts.
Yeah. Now, you know, just not too long ago, I think it was the Center for American Progress did a study of the cases before the court, they found that whenever the Chamber of Commerce puts an amicus brief in, to your point, that they win more than 70% of the time, which is where I keep saying, you know, our court seems to be so biased on the side of the moneyed interests. And look, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't give the court any more credibility. And you would think, you know, being, you know, the high court of the land, the Supreme Court, that you would take that a little bit more seriously than what we're finding out.
I did a published report years ago that looked at the 5-4 decisions of the court, where the 5-4 broke along partisan lines. And in virtually every one of them, there was a very obvious right-wing, big Republican donor interest in the case. And so we dug in a little bit further and looked at the outcomes. And of the, I think it was 73 cases that were 5-4 partisan and had a big right-wing donor interest in, implicated, the score was 73-0.
Wow. 73-0?
73-0. Every single 5-4 partisan case with an identifiable right-wing interest in it went for the identifiable right-wing interest.
So this just goes back and solidifies my view that working people don't have a chance. Because one of the things I talk about all the time here, I fear this court is moving us back into the direction of the Lochner era, where there are no laws that can protect working people, no minimum wage laws, no maximum hour laws, no safe working condition laws, none of that stuff, that we end up back in kind of an oligarch-run country where the court is no friend to working people. So I'm listening to you say this, and man, we're steamrolling towards that.
I think the record of the court gives plenty of evidence for your thesis, and it only got worse when they went from 5-4 to 6-3, and whatever moderating effect Justice Roberts could claim to have was evaporated by him no longer being essential to a majority.
That's an interesting question. What's this going to mean to the Roberts? Because Roberts is a guy that I think legacy matters to him. This is going to tarnish his legacy forever. I think this is going to be what his legacy will be, just how corrupt they appear.
Yeah, my take has been that Roberts will do whatever the big donors expect and want, up to a point where the move is so sudden, so dramatic, so drastic that it risks damaging the reputation of the court. Thomas and Alito are just like him up to that last point, but they don't care very much about the reputation of the court. They just want to get the job done for the donors that put him there.
What do you say, Senator, to the? I had a bunch of people tell me that the whole system's corrupt. It's all bad. This isn't just them. I'm making much ado about nothing. How much of that of this is? You know, this is just how the game has always been played. Are we taking this in the wrong direction?
Well, I would say, first of all, I think dark money has completely rotted out Congress on issues that are important to the big dark money donors. So there are issues in which, you know, I think some general skepticism about Congress and politics is appropriate. And the problem with that is that, yeah, members of Congress have been corrupt forever. Special interests have had improper influence forever. But the court has usually been exempt from that. The court has often been a check on that kind of behavior. And what you've seen recently from the Roberts Court is they've completely thrown in with the anti-democratic, oligarchic, Republican, big money forces in case after case after case. And that's what's discouraging to me, because the court's supposed to be the place where you get a fair shake. And also, the court's really hard to repair if it's gone bad, because it's protected from political influence without any exemption for political influence that's designed to clean the place up.
Right. Now, do you have any faith in John Roberts that he's going to conduct an investigation and that we get to the bottom or any resolution to this? Because I don't. I look at what happened with the Alito leaked document. I have very little faith in this institution, and I think a lot of working people share my skepticism. Do you have any faith that he'll do it? And if he doesn't, you as part of the Judiciary Committee, what are you guys going to do?
I asked him to undertake an investigation of the Thomas incident, and he referred it to the Judicial Conference, which is other federal judges. He's the only Supreme Court justice in the group, who then referred it to their Financial Disclosure Committee. And what's weird about that is that 11 years ago, a similar set of concerns were raised about gifts by Harlan Crow of yacht travel and jet travel to Justice Thomas. And they went also to the Judicial Conference, and from it to the Financial Disclosure Committee. And we have so far been able to determine no sign of there ever having been any outcome or decision.
So what you're telling me is don't have any faith in whatever investigation comes out of this. So which means that you as a legislator.
We need to look at that. We need to find out what happened. And if this is going to be if nothing happened and the investigation just got buried in the Financial Disclosure Committee, and now the second investigation has gone to the same place, then we need an understanding of how that works, what goes on, and who's pulling strings.
Now, I understand you guys are going to have a hearing on June 2nd that Roberts was invited
May
to.
May 2nd, yeah.
What are we expecting to come out of this? What are we hoping for?
Well, Roberts has declined to attend, so we have a panel of experts on judicial ethics who will come in and share their views. I expect what is likely to come out of it is the obvious. They will confirm that if you have a code of judicial ethics and a bunch of ethics statutes that the justices are nominally bound by, but there's no ref to blow the whistle if they break the rules, they're going to figure that out pretty soon. And they're going to come up with some pretty eccentric views of what the rules and the statutes say. And it's very hard to work through that problem. And that will help build the case, I think, for a statutory code of ethics for the Supreme Court with a statutory method of inquiry, examination, determination, and enforcement.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. If you want to check out his website, we'll get links out at the social media how you can do that. I got a question. Ed Markey, senator from Massachusetts, called for Thomas's resignation. Are we on board with that? I mean, is there any way that this, you know, rises to the level of him being ousted? Because I got a lot of my left friends going, you know, we need to impeach, we need to do all this thing, he's going to go. I don't see that happening, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I'm trying to operate in the world of the possible, given that we have a House controlled by the Republicans who are in turn controlled by the same donors who put these judges on the court. So there's not going to be an impeachment under Speaker McCarthy. And, you know, we couldn't get votes to convict on an impeachment against Donald Trump after all he did, set aside Clarence Thomas over this. So I don't think whether it's merited is a separate question. Impeachment is simply not feasible. I think that the way we're going to make progress here is by continuing to put a harsh spotlight on the uniquely peculiar misbehavior of the Supreme Court and provoke the other federal judges who are not on the Supreme Court, who have to abide by the code of ethics, who are subject to investigation and review if there are allegations against them, to get them to the point where they say, okay, enough, you guys, we're not going to put up with this any longer. And the pressure will come from inside the judiciary.
So you think they're going to police themselves? I'm not a big fan of policing themselves. I think there has to be some legislation. If they're not going to oversee themselves and be able to do it, there's got to be something that puts them in this place, which is, you know, brings us to the legislation that you're moving on.
I've got the bill for that.
The Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, SCRT Act. I don't know why we don't already have something like this in place, but tell me about it.
Well, we've always trusted the Supreme Court to police itself, and there have not been instances of misbehavior of this variety in memory. Justice Fortas was involved in far less troubling circumstances and resigned from the court. But these guys don't want to resign. They're on a mission, so we have to deal with them. And the bill would set up they'd have to adopt a code of ethics. They'd have to set up rules of procedure for having themselves investigated by investigators and by, like staff attorneys who do it in the lower courts. There'd have to be a determination. Other judges would make the determination, so it stays within the judicial branch. And then they'd also have to clean up with respect to gifts and hospitality. They'd have to clean up about recusing themselves from cases, and they'd have to require better disclosure of these amici curiae, the friend of the court briefs, where the billionaires send in front groups who they funded to tell the judges what to do, and the justices don't bother to inquire who's funding the front groups. They just allow this whole charade to continue.
Yeah, for me, I, you're going through this again, and it all comes back down to the money, doesn't it? It comes back down to all of this money that we've given a handful of people, which I then come back to where I'm usually at on these issues, is it's time we start taxing these people and using that money in a much more productive way to ensure that not just our institutions are sound, but our country's sound. It just sounds like this is a tax the rich moment for me as well.
Yeah, and, you know, the role of huge amounts of money in all this. I've described it as a noxious cocktail of creepy billionaires, phony front groups, dark money millions, amenable justices, and secrecy. That is not a good combination really anywhere, and it's certainly not a good combination in a court. And the problem is that a vicious cycle has developed in which those forces take over the court, and then the court supports creepy billionaires, phony front groups, dark money millionaires, and secrecy. And that cycle has to be broken and reversed.
See, for me, this is a moment where, you know, I don't care which hat you've got on. I don't care if it's a red hat or a blue hat. I'm going to steal Rupert Murdoch's line. It's not about red or blue. It's about green. This is something that should unite all of us across party lines, because having a Supreme Court that is, well, less than supreme and not above suspicion of impropriety is not good for the country. This should be something universally across party lines. We want to make sure that is cleaned up and, you know, made, I guess, you know, wholesome again.
Yeah. And I think it's a tell when it's not just elected politicians talking about it, but when it becomes more of a topic among other judges. And what I'm hearing is that it has become a topic among other judges, and they're really quite sick of what they're being obliged to have to swallow from the Supreme Court.
Because it makes them look bad, too, I would think. I mean, it makes the whole system look bad.
Yeah, it makes the whole system look bad, particularly when the excuse of the Supreme Court is, oh, we're not breaking any rules here. This is the way the rules are. We're living within them. And regular judges look at that and say, that's ridiculous. That is completely not true. If you were actually subject to enforcement of the rules, you'd know that wasn't true, because we couldn't get away with this. There aren't circuit court of appeals judges taking $500,000 vacations from billionaires. They aren't circuit court of appeals judges rigging the rules so that they can ask the owner of a resort for a vacation and then take it and keep it secret as personal hospitality because the owner of the resort invited them personally, even if they don't know the person. You know, stuff like that, there's just no way that's credible in any other court.
No, and here's the thing, and maybe it's just because I'm getting older. I'm old enough to remember when this was wrong. I'm old enough to remember when this would have been something that would have outraged everyone until someone had to resign. I'm old enough to remember.
Like Jane Fortas did.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that this is something that we shouldn't want, and not something that's based on politics, right or left, but right or wrong. And this is wrong to me. It smells of wrong in every way. So the last line of questioning I've got for you is, you know, how do we pull people around to remembering that this is wrong? Take off the red hat, take off the blue hat. This is about the green, to steal from Rupert.
Yeah, I think constant exposure to the facts of what is going on is really important. I think Roberts and the Federal Society of Justices on the court are hoping for the next big news cycle to blow this away, and they can go back to previous ways of doing business. The last episode in which Clarence Thomas didn't report his wife's income from the right-wing front group, the Heritage Foundation, was back in 2011. And here we are in 2022.
Yeah.
Back then, he was accused of taking gifts of yacht travel and jet travel from Harlan Crow. Here we are in 2022 having to relive it. So I think this time we just need to stick with it and make sure we don't let it get away from us and keep the pressure on and hope and pray that either a glimmer of conscience in Chief Justice Roberts or pressure from the rest of the bench gets a cleanup.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where we'll finish this. You know, average working people like me, average people listening to this program know that if you lie on a form, there's consequences. If you do the kind of things that he's being accused of, there are consequences. And sadly, there will be no consequences for Clarence Thomas other than a black check on his record down the line. That's what I think. That's what infuriates me, Senator.
Yeah. Well, I think for a lot of people who are state and local employees as well, I was on a phone call and a caller said that she was, a state employee, maybe a local municipal employee in West Virginia. And she had to report when she went out someplace and they served lunch and it was like a $5 lunch. And she had to go through all these, you know, reports about the $5 lunch that she got. And, you know, here's a guy who's taking yacht trips and jet plane, private jet trips and having his mom put up rent free in a house that a billionaire owns. The whole thing is just unacceptable to regular people.
I'm right there with you. Senator, I appreciate the time. I look forward to the hearing on the 2nd. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on how this is going down the road.
Will do. Gladly, Rick. Thanks for the attention to this.
Thank you so much, Senator. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, whitehouse.senate.gov, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that he's doing. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day the AFL-CIO held a Jobs Now rally in Washington, D.C. A painful recession had pushed unemployment in the U.S. to 9%. Many workers across the nation thought the Ford administration was not doing enough to address the needs of working families. 60,000 people, many of them union members carrying banners representing their unions, gathered in RFK Stadium. There they heard speeches, including one from Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, who had served as vice president under Lyndon B. Johnson. His speech described the devastating impact of unemployment. Senator Humphrey said, "Our nation must recommit itself to the goal and the promise of full employment, a job for every American who is willing and able to work. Perhaps we would get bolder action and more compassion from this administration if some of its top advisors had a little taste of unemployment themselves. Perhaps they would know what unemployment is. It's drawing your last unemployment check with no job in sight. It's sitting in the dark to save on the light bill. It's making shoes last another month and driving on bald tires. It's eating a little less so the kids can eat a little more. It's facing eviction because you can't pay the rent or meet the mortgage. It's borrowing from your brother-in-law or letting your insurance lapse. It's facing yourself in the mirror and asking why and how much longer. It's wondering how a nation this rich, this enterprising, this great can let more than 8 million Americans who want to work and need to work go without work." Some protesters rushed the stage at the rally, causing it to end early. But his questions still remain. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I look at this, and the angering part of all this is they do it right out in public, right out in front of us. And I've been screaming about this for years. I mean, Senator Whitehouse brought up the fact that, you know, back in 11, I think it was on 60 Minutes, actually, that Clarence Thomas was talking about all the gifts that he had gotten and all, you know, driving his big RV and the money for Ginny to go work at the Heritage Foundation and do all the Tea Party stuff she did. Because, hey, you know, access to a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice gets you kind of a high paying gig. But it's even more than that. I mean, it's not just Thomas. Understand, it's all of them. It was, what did the one Times report say? Scalia took more than 250 subsidized trips. In fact, the one he died on, where he died, he was on one of these subsidized trips. He was on a hunting ranch owned by some guy named Poindexter. And you go, why? Now, Scalia used to whine all the time that he believed he was underpaid. But I guess you throw in the perks, you know. Stephen Breyer, they say, took more than 225 subsidized trips from 2004 to 2018. And look, the numbers are all there. This isn't. It's what they've been doing for a while. But it's gotten really just completely out of hand. And one of the things that the Times pointed out is that they hold these black tie events and they trot these justices around and, you know, to get access to them. And they hold an annual black tie dinner where the ticket is at least $5,000 to get in. How many working people got $5,000 to go to a rubber chicken dinner? How many? None that I know of. These are the rich and powerful. These are the special interests that we now have a Supreme Court historical society that raised last year, according to the Times, $6.4 million from special interests and groups that have business in front of the court. Because why else would you go other than to get that 5 minutes to talk with the justice? You know, hey,
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZ H910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News.
App.